Welcome, welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's Chef Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including Lola downstairs from where we tape here at the Hot Stove Society, and of course the Carlisle Room across from the Paramount, which I had brunch at last week when I went to see the show Waitress. First time I had actually sat down in the dining room for brunch in quite a long time, instead of just being on the kitchen side or just observing. It was quite delicious. I had a cheesy corn pie. You know, we had a whole pie menu for the show Waitress in the last couple of weeks, and it was super fun.
That
had a little pie
delicious.
And salad, a little savory pie and salad. Loved it.
And I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in hat, owner of two restaurants in Seattle, Luc in Madison Valley, 28 and Madison, and the Lule downtown Seattle at 6 and Union, bottom of the Sheraton.
Where you can get an egg on your burger.
You can get an egg on your burger.
That's right. Well,
you can actually get two if you want to.
Or two.
Nobody's going to stop you.
That's right. And I'm Katie O, your co-host and biggest fan. We've got things at both of your restaurants that I love so much, like hanging out with you guys every week.
Thank you, Katie. That's the nicest thing you've ever said.
I try every once a business quarter.
Today on the show, we're going to talk to Sean Dwyer, a captain from the TV show The Deadliest Catch. And we're going to talk crab a bit with him. Sharing our tips and tricks. We're going to share our tips and tricks on frying safely and deliciously. Sean's got a lot of work to do today. And we're going to... KDO, you're going to host a dinner party.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
I always know that I'm going to host a dinner party, of course.
Of course, the hard thing about that is using the same ingredient in every course.
That's right.
Where Chef Terry and I and our fabulous ad lib capabilities are.
Also known as BS.
Yeah. Flexing those creative muscles is what I like to think. Yeah.
Can't wait to find out who is going to be our special guest.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we're going to go toe to toe on tasty trivia. For which I believe you and I lost last week.
We did not do so well.
No, we did not.
Terry really kicked our butts.
Yes, indeed. But first, let's go ordinary to extraordinary.
Uh-huh. This is where you take some ordinary ingredients or dishes. You make them extraordinary with all that creativity we were just referring to. And we like to use the national food holidays as our guide in this particular segment. And the first national holiday we have coming up is on the 30th, and it's for mulled cider. Mulled cider. How do you make an extraordinary mulled cider?
So do tell us what mulled cider is first. What's a mulled cider?
Mulled cider.
That's like when an apple cider gets in the way of a bear.
Mulled cider.
Mulled cider.
Mulled cider.
Everybody, whoa.
Yeah, the audience made a collective, that was a dad joke sound. Like, we want to find it funny.
That was a bad Thanksgiving joke.
Right. Mulled cider, gosh, what are the spices normally involved in mulled
Clove
cider?
Clove and cinnamon stick and the warm kind of fall spices.
Yeah, I think maybe a star anise in there. Maybe,
so
I don't know.
You can only put a part of one. That spice
stuff is
pretty,
super strong. Yeah, maybe a little orange peel.
Mm-hmm.
That's a mulled cider.
You warm it
warmed up.
So how do you take that and make it extraordinary?
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say add some brandy.
I would leave out the mulling spices and drink the fresh, delicious cider.
I would say take the cider, go light on the spices, but add some Calvados.
There you go.
Because Calvados
fortified.
Is made
Chef,
with,
now you're
Calvados
talking my language.
Calvados is made with apple. You just add in a little apple brandy into your mulled cider and then... somehow everything looks much better after that.
Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty extraordinary. I'll take that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Let's move on to the next one. It is National. I didn't even know that this was a thing. National Fried Scallop Day on the 2nd.
I mean, just is it scallop or fried scallop?
It specifically says fried scallops.
No, who fried scallops?
I have done it in the past.
Pan-seared is what
good?
They mean, or
not particularly.
Like...
I'm just. I mean, it's like scallops don't have a ton of flavor in the first place, and so.
They also cook very fast.
Like squid, it ends up, you just taste the deep fryer, the breading in the deep fryer generally. So
it's all about the breading.
Which is sometimes okay.
If you go to any of those classic East Coast seafood restaurants or, say, Ivor's Acres of Clams or something, when they used to have the captain's plate with all the different seafood they had in the kitchen fried and on the same plate.
Right. I do love a captain's platter.
Yeah, that's where you end up with fried scallops quite often. You don't see them at Spuds very much.
So it would be all about the batter and all about the dipping sauce that you're going to use for it.
Yeah, exactly. Like calamari. People don't love it because it tastes like squid. They love it because it tastes like the deep fryer.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, because actually it tastes like nothing to start with.
And the bouncy texture.
Why do people like elephant ears?
It's just fried.
I think they're kind of tough, and they're huge. Even Sean got a little chuckle out of that one.
It's always good when you crack Sean.
Fried scallop is all about the dipping sauce. So make a good dipping sauce, fresh herbs, olive oil. That's what I would do. Fresh herb, olive oil, a little garlic, salt, pepper, lots of fresh herbs, you know, and make like a beautiful fresh herb dipping sauce, and you'll have a great fried scallop with your dipping sauce.
So I would also say in a scenario like that, it's a good time to experiment with rice flour and cornstarch as your dredge.
A little bit lighter.
Because much lighter, no batter, but just a light dredge. And then you can almost pan deep fry. So you're not necessarily needing a deep fryer, but you can just put maybe a half an inch of oil in the bottom of the pan, give them a quick turn.
Yep.
And go like that.
I like that idea. All right. On the 3rd, it is National Pumpkin and Pumpkin Seed Day.
Uh-huh.
What you gonna do?
Me?
Yep.
I love those, sugar pie pumpkins where you just wedge them, leave the skin on, wedge them, take the seeds out, roast them, and then just caramelize them. You could do it with a little cream sherry marinade, and that sherry will, if you cook them low and slow, that sherry will caramelize right onto the outside of the pumpkin. And it's just a delicious, savory way. Finish with savory, the herb, because I'd love savory and pumpkin together for some reason. And
same thing for me. I would bake it. I would probably make it into a soup, toasted hazelnut, little goat cheese, fresh goat cheese of Idaho, you know, just as a soup. And you've got a wonderful lunch on your hand. You know, it's not pumpkin soup with goat cheese and toasted hazelnut. Yeah, I'm in.
Or you could toast those pumpkin seeds.
You could toast the pumpkin seeds and add it to the soup, which would be even better.
Delish.
Okay, up next, we're going to combine thoughts here. This is going to be a little bit of a agree or disagree. And we're going to talk about the subject is going to be cooking small, where you don't really have a kitchen. Maybe you only have a microwave, so that could be a small apartment. It could be a college student heading into a dorm where they're not supposed to have any cooking utensils, but we're going to tell them how to cheat. Like my daughter had, you know, stashed it under her bed, had a toaster oven, the sand.
Contraband.
Luckily, she didn't burn down the whole Colgate University.
I know, then what?
I think that's one of the reasons they don't want them to have anything hot.
On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. We're here for 2 hours every Saturday and Sunday. Thank you so much for joining us. Obviously, we have a live audience that's completely into us.
They're not using us at all for the breakfast that they're about to have.
No, not a bit.
No, not at all.
It's all about us.
That's right.
So they've been very good with their applause.
We backed up the breakfast for another hour, just in case.
I know. As soon as they get the breakfast, they won't do what we tell them to do anymore.
Yes. Held hostage.
Katie, we're going to talk a little bit about going back to school in your dorm room.
That's right.
Going to a small apartment that doesn't really, an efficiency, say, that doesn't have much of a stove, maybe only has a microwave.
Mm-hmm.
What are some tricks? I believe.
That is what we want to know from you, because we also know that you two are very creative and could probably cook just about anything under any circumstance, gun to the head sort of situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people are going back to school, as you said, Tom, and are, how shall I put this, lacking in equipment. Mm-hmm. It's not really allowed in the dormitories. So really,
you were an RA. You know
I
that.
I was an RA. I also had a very big spending account as an RA, so I was buying a lot of pizzas for people on my floor. But if you want to cook something because you're going to be up late at night and you need a little fortification, oftentimes the only appliance you have is the microwave.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go down that route a little bit and get some professional tips for some dorm goers on what they can cook in their room.
So my first advice is if you're going to cook in the microwave something substantial, don't use anything that needs to be seared or to be grilled or to be any of that kind of high heat.
Mm-hmm.
Use something that needs to be warmed up, poached, or, you know, use that kind of thinking, because otherwise you won't get the results you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with utensils. So you've got your microwave.
I would say you need a little oven, toaster oven.
Oh, you need a little oven.
Wait. That's a different piece of equipment.
Just start by getting
Terry
would
like
of
a $5,000 Turbo Chef yeah. in his dorm room.
A Vitamix, yeah. a KitchenAid stand mixer, bring in a KitchenAid oven.
Where is my RoboCoo?
It's in the parking lot. It's stored in my U-Haul.
No, but realistically, let's try to stick with this microwave
okay.
theme.
Okay,
what?
Sure.
What? Well, supplies do you need?
Supplies, you need a glass bowl, yep. we'll say, right? Anything mm-hmm. that glass or plastic.
No metal.
People say that the plastic is not really a good thing to be using in there, so I would just go with a glass bowl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you can start to wrangle everything from ramen, right? You start to make your own version of ramen,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is really fun. It's an easy doctor when you think about it in that way, right?
Yep.
So now you've got a two-quart glass bowl. And you want about 1 quart of soup. So you want it to be, you know, low enough below the rim that it's mm-hmm. not a problem. So now you've just got, let's say you've got, what's your favorite cup of noodles?
Oh, I'll take any of them at Wajumaya, honestly.
Okay, so let's say it's Lipton cup of noodles. I don't know, or Nissan cup of noodles.
Nissan, yeah.
So you pour that in, you pour your water in. But now, instead of just being done, now you start to add some ingredients that
That's
can
right.
make it better. And Roy Choi in L.A. is famous for his... American cheese in his ramen
That's
because
right.
he calls it just hydrogenated fat oil, which is what it is.
That
there's
is
very
pretty,
little dairy in
yeah,
there.
Right. Umami
and it
flavors.
Melts and gets stringy. Just literally crack an egg into your soup. It'll sit there when it's cold, right? It'll
mm-hmm.
sit there in
right.
place. But when you put it the microwave on, it'll cook in place too. So
yeah,
you'll have a nice poached egg
yeah.
right in your ramen. Any sort of shredded lunch meat would go good in there,
yep.
so that you can add a little bit of meat to, you know, chicken or turkey or whatever to your ramen, or throw a couple of shrimp in there.
Get classy, put
you
some scallions in.
You don't have to do much
in.
Of anything, but just load the bowl and then turn it on and cook the whole darn
That's
thing.
That's right.
And you've got a better ramen than it came in that little
right.
Styrofoam cup mm-hmm. or whatever they mm-hmm. come in. So,
what about canned foods? Any thoughts on canned tinned
Take
foods?
Them out of the can before you put them in the microwave. It's a very good idea.
Okay.
First advice.
I would rather eat dog food than eat canned chili, I think. So, I mean, it's like,
I think
to me, there's not...
Yeah, I'm with Tom. I think, you know, in today's world, there's so many options. You can go to any restaurants and take to-go food and then warm it up in your microwave.
Mm-hmm.
You can also... go to a deli and get some nice little stew of some kind and just ready to pop in the oven, you know, in the microwave mm-hmm. oven. So warming up, I mean, you could literally call Luc and order a bœuf bourguignon and pop it in your refrigerator.
Well, you are a classy college student. Should you be ordering
stews.
Beef bourguignon?
The point of reference I'm trying to make is a stew. You know, you can buy so many different things. Just store them in your little refrigerator in small, very small quantities, small container, and then pop them in the microwave. The point is that you don't have to do anything to it to be delicious. You know, you could buy a piece of quiche Lorraine in a nice deli. Obviously, quiche Lorraine is a good deli. You could buy a quiche Lorraine and then keep it in your refrigerator and then pop in the microwave, and you're still eating some good food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're eating something decent.
Another thing that I think about, which is that could be applicable for dorm food, which is when, for me personally, my apartment is too hot and I do not feel like cooking or turning on the stove or the oven. And in comes all those fresh veggies. If you've got a little fridge in your dormitory, there are a lot of options when it comes to cooking in that manner,
mm-hmm.
which is not really cooking, but it's really composing things.
And I think that's one of the tools you need in your pantry, or as a minimum, you need tools to mix, so big spoon or whatever, and you need a big mixing bowl. You know, get the bigger mm-hmm. bowl you can possibly get, so you can never be short on your size of bowl. But a bowl can help to mix a lot of different things. So
a whisk to make your dressings. I would also say, you know, here's a tasty
tip. You don't
tip.
Need a whisk. Just a fork.
Just a fork. Yeah, you're right.
You have to go minimal.
You're right. You have to go minimal.
Mm-hmm.
I just like
have
whisks
a jar. Have
so
a
much.
Jar of grape poupon. That's much more important. So you can put your dressing in it and shake the heck out of it.
But you do have to eat quite a bit of the grape poupon before you can.
Well, I'm using grape poupon as an example.
Yeah. I would also say charcuterie plates.
Yeah.
Even if it's just a simple salami
and cheese
and some apples, that always feels like a nice meal replacement.
Yeah, olives.
Mm-hmm.
Olives are great. They stay really well in your refrigerator. They're a great tool to have to munch on. They're very tasty, and they're filling.
What about the electric tea kettle? What can you do with the electric tea kettle? Because that's another one that I think is A-OK by dormitory standards.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't know outside of using it for hot water, rehydrating things, right?
Right.
So
that's
really kind of the big one for me.
Well, if you were getting a bowl of pho, I mean, if you have the microwave, you can warm all that stuff in the microwave. You don't really need the tea kettle to do that.
So you could put the... Are you saying you could put the pho broth into your kettle and heat
right.
that
if you
up?
Right. If you didn't have the microwave, you could warm up your broth of your pho into the kettle mm-hmm. and then pour it over the noodles.
Now, I wonder if electric appliances are allowed if the Instapot, if you could have an Instapot.
Well, then in that case, you've got your couscous ready when you get home.
That's right. Something to think about. Ask your local dormitory. You can get that Instapot in there. Sneak it in.
Well, I don't see why not. If you can have a hot tea kettle, why not?
Yeah. Right. That's what I'm saying.
That's easy.
Except your dorm's going to smell like a wonderful restaurant and everybody's going to jump on
that. Oh, my gosh. You're going to be the most popular kid.
Better than doing roasted broccoli in your toaster oven.
That's true.
Then your dorm really is going to stink.
Then no one wants to hang out with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are I think, natural things.
Right.
A little electric burner with a saute pan, you can do a million things, right? So... grilled cheese sandwiches and all sorts of things in that.
Just don't be too lazy when it's good food for you. Go, you know, to me, I'm like, bring good food to your place and then warming it up is not that hard.
And feed your friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Be generous.
And then pitch in. Have everybody pitch in so you can get a bigger piece of roast at the deli, for example, and then slice it and have them slice it for you and then put it in the microwave so you have a roast for everybody.
Yeah.
Those are good little...
Make friends.
I know my daughter always cooked. Her boyfriend was on the football team, so she always cooked for the guys.
That's a lot of food for the football players.
Yeah, but they had fun. They would all go to the store. They would buy the food, and then she would cook it. And it was she met a lot of people
popular.
That. Yeah, she met a lot of people that way. Up next, Captain Sean Dwyer is here of The Deadliest Catch, and we're going to talk crab and the upcoming National Seafood Month on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Hey, welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
We're here at the Hot Stove Society, where you too could come and hang out with us, as this lively audience is doing, because they just got their breakfast finally. See, no claps. When they get their breakfast, they don't clap anymore.
They're comatose.
Captain Sean Dwyer is here of The Deadliest Catch. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Appreciate Absolutely.
It. Say captain, say what?
Yeah. Say ahoy.
Ahoy.
Yep, sure. Yeah, sure.
Captain Sean, what did you bring to us here today?
Well, today I'm with our industry trade group, Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers, and we brought you some of the finest Alaska Bering Sea king crab right here. These are jumbo sections, and Key Port hooked us up with some of our best product, and take a little taste.
It is an embarrassment of riches right now, is what the radio listeners cannot see.
I mean, I've had king crab in my life. These are healthy crab
those
legs.
Those are big ones. Those are the
those
ones.
Those are big,
when we
fat
pull
ones.
Pull those up, we are just like high fiving and screaming and yelling. I mean, that's like when we sell that at the dock. That's like $100 crab.
Right?
So that's
for
$100
you.
To you, yeah.
To
that
us.
Makes
for
it $500 to me.
Yeah, exactly.
So what we're talking about here, I know you can't see them on the radio, but these legs themselves are about almost 24 inches long, and they probably weigh, what, a pound and a quarter?
I think so, yeah. They're definitely a pound and a quarter.
Each leg is a pound and a quarter to a pound and a half, and they when you take the shell off of them, just one crab leg section is over 6 inches long. So it is an amazing creature. And is it like tuna, where the bigger they are, the more money you get for them?
No, you know, we get paid by the pound. So that right there with these legs, probably like an $8 or $9 per pound crab. So
so you get paid by the pound, but also by size, right?
No, it's all by the pound.
So.
But the more bigger crab you catch, the fewer you have to catch.
Okay, correct.
So then the grading of the size after that.
That happens after
then they
the
change
fact.
To more expensive for the bigger.
So you don't get the money because of the size, but the guy after you does.
Yeah, you know, we work pretty hard for him out there.
You guys need to rethink this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I tell you what, I mean, it's hard to bring these things into the boat. I mean, if you watch the show Deadliest Catch, you'll see the effort and all of the weather and hardships we go through
it
to get those things.
It looks frightening.
At times.
Is
yeah,
it?
I'm not going to lie to you.
I was going to say, you're a burly dude, but does it freak you out sometimes out
Absolutely.
There?
I mean, the weather is incredible, and as well as we can capture it on camera, it still doesn't show all of the craziness.
Yeah, I can't imagine with all those big waves crashing and trying to work at the same time.
It's kind of like being stuck in a 747 at 35,000 feet knowing you're going through a tornado or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, with the, with like the top of the thing. Airplane off.
You
yeah.
have nowhere yeah. to go. Yeah. You're stuck in that little box. And, I mean, the boat on the ocean is, once you start putting
you're
that
remote. Yeah.
in perspective, it's pretty scary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that explains a little bit about why crab is so expensive. It's also, despite what it looks like, you know, the thousands of pounds you catch on TV, it's pretty rare.
It is. It is a rare resource. In Alaska, king crab is the most sustainable king crab in the world, hands down. Mm-hmm. And this year alone, we as an industry have worked really hard to get Russian imports down, illegal Russian crab mm-hmm. coming into the U.S. Mm-hmm. We've worked really hard. It's down, as of today, 23% since January 2018.
Nice.
And so that's also what's driving the price up of the crab. But when you want to talk about having some crab for next year and the year after that, I mean, you get what you pay for. Alaska is the most sustainable product. Sustainability is in Alaska's state constitution. It's mm-hmm. a foundation of what we do up there. And I mean, it's, you know, you're getting what you pay for sure.
Right. So how old is a crab like this?
I would guess probably 6 or 7 years. It's really actually really tough to date a crab. Because they molt.
Yeah, I know. I heard.
They're, yeah.
They're not on Tinder.
Well, they're not on Tinder.
Yeah, you can't swipe right on a crab.
There's no Crab or Craigslist personal section. Yeah. We're working on it. If you check out our website, maybe
so,
next year.
It'd be so much easier. Your job would be so much easier.
Yeah. So if I had to guess, I'd say it's 6 or 7 year crab. But they shed their shell every year.
Right.
And, you know, every year they get bigger, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's these are some...
So that's a pretty, you say it's very sustainable, which is, that means there must be a bazillion crab on the
no,
bottom.
No, that's not necessarily what that means. That means that the state of Alaska keeps an eye on the catch, right?
Got it.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
which
is so that, it's controlled by the state.
Yeah, well, I think the suggestion with the Russian crab is that they don't have the same quota system.
Well,
they
right,
don't have
right,
the
right.
same sustainability model that Alaska does.
That's and, 100% exactly yeah. that. And, you know, we have both state and federal resources monitoring our crab mm-hmm. fisheries. And then we also, as an industry, we fund an individual effort separate of any government body, the Bering Sea Fisheries Research Foundation, to go out alongside the state and federally hired boats mm-hmm. to survey and compare notes, basically. So we want, I mean, as fishermen, this is my job. I'm fifth generation Alaska fisherman. I want to have a job next year. So we're trying really hard.
We want you to have a job
yeah.
next year, too.
I want to bring this stuff back.
Yeah. We just want you to stay alive.
Also
yeah.
that.
Well, thank
most,
you.
Most importantly, we want you to stay alive, but congratulations to you
yeah. thank
for keeping
you.
This alive.
So
yeah.
October is National Seafood Month, and to celebrate local fishing organizations like yours, the Port of Seattle, the Seattle Propeller Club, they've joined together through Seafood 101 campaign. And the goals of this campaign are to encourage folks to eat more seafood and to discover the nutritional value, which I think is sometimes lost on, wow, this is delicious. Well, it's actually good for you, too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's also to highlight the commitment to sustainability, which we just talked about a little bit. And that is generally happens through reasonable management. And we see this in our world, Chef. No matter what fishery it is, salmon, halibut, you name it, local rockfish off the coast of Washington is all being managed
right.
to a sustainable point that, matter of fact, they just closed Columbia now for almost all salmon fishing because they just weren't coming back, right? They were
right.
They monitored the ladders and in the process, and there's just no
fish coming. We have to be back. Responsible.
And then also this Seafood 101 month is to celebrate the economic fortunes that come from the fisheries. And by those economic fortunes, it's not all going into Sean's pocket and to my pocket and to your pocket. That economic fortune goes to the whole process.
Absolutely.
Right? Which is why yeah. we fight so hard for pebble right. anti-pebble mining.
Yeah, I love mm-hmm. I love your sign over there. I do work in the summertime. Most crabbers do.
So the sign is an anti-pebble mine sign.
Yep. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, fishing is a whole economy. The maritime industry, especially here in Seattle, is huge. And mm-hmm. it's almost sometimes forgotten about.
Right.
So it's
yeah.
great to realize just what it takes. I mean, you've got For example, this crab came from Keyport, which is a Seattle-based company, and it's family-owned and operated, and that's how most of these businesses are. And it's cool. I mean, really, it's kind of some of the last, you know, bread and butter family industries that are thriving out here.
Yeah, if you want to not forget about how important fishing is, just drive over the Ballard Bridge and go look at Fisherman's Terminal.
Come check out our boat. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, or drive down I-5 and look at the net yard along the railroad tracks down there. They're always working the nets.
Absolutely.
And Tom says, even though it sounds kind of strange, you have to eat the product in order to keep it alive.
Yeah, that's true.
You have to buy the crab. You have to eat the crab in order to keep the crab fishermen alive. Otherwise, there is no sustainability there.
Well, yes, it's the supporting of the industry. And again, these multi-generational families and businesses, I mean, it's really important to support all the work that's being done around the sustainability.
Right, and I think that's what Terry's sort of referring to as the eat wild to save wild.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if you don't create the economy around the fish, or the fishery, or the crabbery, or however you want to describe it, then the locals have no choice but to choose things that might not be as good for all of us.
And
like the largest open-pit copper mine in the world in the headwaters of Bristol Bay.
We don't need that.
No, we don't.
Because the headwaters of Bristol Bay are exactly where these king crab came from. Mm-hmm. Further down the road, maybe 100 miles away, that's where these crab come from. And what's also really important about all that is just labeling the product as such and being proud as we are to support, you know, the name Wild Alaskan Seafood. I mean, so actually for king crab, cooked king crab, legally we are not allowed to label it as Alaskan product or product of the USA. It's exempt right now, but we push really hard. You know, we're not required. I shouldn't say we're not allowed to, but we do it. But when you look at a crab box and if it doesn't say Wild Alaskan Seafood, it's because it's not.
Right.
So they're not required to label it as, you know, where it's coming from. Country of origin labeling is not required.
Really?
Cooked crab is exempt. But anytime you see Wild Alaskan, that's it. I mean, it's we're really proud to show it.
Good. Well, next week we're going to do a segment on how to cook king crab, how to clean king crab. Where to find this luscious ingredient at local markets, because some markets carry the real deal and others don't, right?
Right.
So,
right.
I'd love some information for our listeners on how to ask for when you want the larger legs compared to the smaller legs, that sort of thing. So you'll have to listen in next week to hear the end of our king crab story right here on Cairo Radio with Sean Dwyer from The Deadliest Catch on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas. Chef in the Chapeau is here. Katie O is here.
That's right.
And we're going to talk fryers.
Ooh, deep frying, one of the most delicious ways to cook anything.
Right.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would say about frying is that you don't really have to have a fryer, right?
No.
I personally keep two kinds of fryers in my house.
Let's,
I keep a cast iron pan that I utilize over and over and over again so that when it gets black and gross, you don't have to clean it. And so that's I keep that. And they're only about, $20 for a cast iron fryer?
Yeah, you can get them anywhere.
Right.
Sporting goods stores, hardware stores.
Mm-hmm. And then also I keep my wok. My wok makes a great fryer.
Mm-hmm. So, a saute pan a sauce pot makes also a good fryer if you have a any kind of like 2-quart sauce pot, that makes a great fryer.
Yeah, but it's hard to clean though
Well, the secret of cleaning a fryer is do it right after you've done frying.
Uh-huh.
Because it's still hot and not, you know, if you wait and you put it away and you wait 2 weeks later and do it again, that's done. You can't clean it.
Frying.
So you choose.
Deep frying feels like an arduous task when you're at home because you're thinking, wow, this is going to require a lot of oil. A lot of heat in the house, and the smell. I think a lot of people are very concerned about the smell
I think that's
of one's
more where
house.
It's at.
You think that's where it's
I
at?
I think it's much more into, I mean, people buy anything in volume, or they're not afraid of that. They go shop at Costco, so they're not afraid of that, but they're afraid of the smell that lingers in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's like, you know, food that lingers in your house has a smell. If you do it correctly, it doesn't smell bad. It just smells like you fried something. You know, and it's not going to stay forever.
It won't stay forever.
It'll only stay as long as you don't clean your curtains.
Clean your curtains. Air out your home.
As long as you don't repaint your house.
It will stay until you start burning some garlic in the house. Yeah.
So you're deep frying at home, and I think there are some reasons to try it out. You know, we often are out and about eating French fries, like, you know, like it's just raining from the heavens.
Right.
But they're actually quite complicated to make for a lot of people. So let's take just the basic fry. How would you go about deep frying that French fry at home?
Well, I'll tell you how we do it at the restaurants. Yes. It's the same idea. So we take the potatoes, we run them through the French fry cutter, and then we soak them in water. And then after they soak for a day,
starch out?
I guess so. I don't know the science behind it.
Mm-hmm.
After they soak, we then drain them, and we deep fry them once. We blanch them in a little lower temperature oil,
mm-hmm.
so more like in that 300-degree area. And then we put them on sheet pans, and we put them into the refrigerator or into the freezer. And then when we go to cook them to order,
mm-hmm.
when you order them in the restaurant, we pull those blanched fries out, and we, in a hotter oil, deep fry them until they're crispy.
Nice and crisp.
And that's how we do our fries. Chef, how about you?
That is how you make a French fries.
Okay.
That is how you make a French fry.
Yeah, I mean, it's very basic. The most important part is to remember that if you just fry your potato in one batch only and you don't blanch them ahead of time, you will have a very crispy potato on the outside that won't have much flavor on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Where the blanching allows the inside to be soft and to be delicious.
So when we're taking the humble potato and we're going to deep fry it at home, or maybe we're deep frying anything, how important is the type of oil that you're choosing to deep fry with?
Well, whatever you're deep frying will taste like the oil. So
right.
that could be a neutral oil like canola oil. It could be a little bit stronger oil like peanut oil. Or you could go all
duck
the way
fat.
To beef tallow where you're cooking and it tastes like beef.
Yeah.
Like beef
right.
tallow or duck fat, right?
Right.
You could use olive oil, which is more expensive, but it certainly fries beautifully. So it really depends on the flavor profile you want after frying.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that there is a textural difference, say, frying in beef tallow versus a canola?
Me, no.
No. I don't think, I mean, there might be a slight texture difference if you really are picking them one next to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, it's not the texture. It's more like what Tom said, the flavor. What you're looking for in terms of flavor. You could also take a regular canola oil and put spices in it and get a very flavored oil. You
mm-hmm.
could flavor your own oil. You could use fresh herb and put it into your oil when it's at low temperature, and then you'd have a flavored oil than you would have to fry with.
Many recipes when you're deep frying at home call for a very specific temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk about temping your oil correctly. How would you go about making sure that it is the appropriate temperature for what you are cooking?
Right.
Use a frying thermometer.
or a frying thermometer.
Yeah. Yeah, the other one. My wife,
one of those.
My wife always makes me fun of me because I can't say the word.
We're laughing with you, chef. Not
no,
acting.
I get it. Don't worry, I got my own gun.
What's the French version of thermometer?
Thermometer.
Oh, is it?
No, thermomètre.
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 Okay.
Thermomètre. Okay, let's move on to another deep frying topic, which
yep.
is when do you throw away that oil? So maybe you've cooked your French fries. Is it time to throw away the oil? How long can you keep that oil?
Mm-hmm. Not with one batch. And if you keep your oil very cold or refrigerated, it won't go bad on you that easily, meaning that you have a long shelf life,
mm-hmm.
at least a month. And if you do not keep your oil, if you keep your oil on the counter, it will go bad. Oil is a life product, you know, so it will go rancid on you within a few weeks, especially in the heat of the summer, it goes bad fairly
quickly. And you've got food particulate in there.
Correct.
And so
mm-hmm.
it's working away.
The first thing you should do when you're done frying is use a coffee filter and strain your oil. So you have no particles of food left into your oil, which will delay the oil going bad.
Right. So you put your filter right into one of the plastic funnels,
yep.
which is right on top of the container
no.
that you got your oil out of,
mm-hmm.
and just reload that, put it in the fridge, and now you're ready for the next one.
Yeah.
Unless...
But just make sure you wait till the oil cools off, because if you use a plastic fennel...
yeah. It's all over.
I've seen it before, where the plastic fennel melts into the oil.
So then if you're doing fish and chips or fried squid, you're done.
You're done,
So
yeah.
that should be the last use of your oil. You can do 10 batches of French fries, but as soon as you add seafood or protein like a chicken to
mm-hmm.
it, then I would be done with the oil.
Right.
Right. So make your donuts, make your French fries, and then move on to your final products, your protein products.
And then you
products.
Can keep a little bit of that frying oil to use as a dressing. You know, let's say you're doing squid. You can use a little bit of that oil, cool it off a little bit, and then make like an aioli mayonnaise or whatever that's going to go with your squid using
Tom
some of that oil.
Tom is making a very upset face at you right now. Tom, what are you feeling? You're having some feelings.
Chef and I just don't agree on this. It's okay.
If you keep your oil at the right temperature and you don't burn the oil, it will be more than fine. It will just have a little flavor.
Okay. Whatever you say, oui, chef. I would say also a mistake that people make is that they tend to dump the second batch of ingredients. You know, oftentimes you can't do the whole batch of frying at one time, so they tend to dump the second batch without temping the oil a second time. And you want to make sure that you get the oil back up to the original temp.
Correct.
And the other thing is that you need to have a decent amount of flame under your fryer.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get scared. I mean, be careful it doesn't bubble over the sides.
Right.
But when you dump a whole thing of cold squid into a batch of oil, it's going to cool down the oil.
Right.
And you want to keep that flame hot. And that's another reason why a cast iron pan works good, because it levels out your heat.
Right.
It doesn't chill off.
And also a frying thermometer is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Because it keeps you instructed. I mean, it tells you exactly where the heat is at. And then, you know, you want to have a hot oil, but you don't want to have a oil so hot that you're like cooking in a wok. That's too hot.
Top fried item that someone should try at home.
French fries. Start with French fries.
I would
get used
say French
to the oil.
Fries. Yeah.
French fries.
Potatoes is a good one.
Learn how to fry first.
Exactly.
All right. Up next, our favorite taste of the week on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas. We're here for one more hour. Please hang with us. Chef.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat. Do hang with us.
Yes, and I'm Katie O, hanging with you.
Things that are coming up in this next hour, we have, of course, a dinner party at Katie O's house,
mm-hmm.
which I think maybe we should have king crab this week. Oh, my goodness.
I don't see why we wouldn't. I just had a little nibble.
I'm full of king crab.
Yeah.
Delicious.
That's
so good.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Food for thought. Tasty trivia still coming. Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery is in the baker's corner. And first, Sarah, you have a thought on an article you read in the Seattle Times.
Yeah, so this came up because there's an article in the Seattle Times talking about Cinerama's popcorn, mm-hmm. and particularly whether or not it's good.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me thinking about places that you don't think of for food, you don't go there specifically for their food, but that have great food.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering what some of your favorite places that you, when you end up there.
Well, let's start with the Cinerama, because that was the big article.
Yes.
That was
you got a little mention in there too for the pretzel.
For the Brave Horse pretzel, mm-hmm. they sell our pretzel there at Cinerama, mm-hmm. but it is interesting to find a place where you don't expect food. And there's also the controversial part in that article, because people either love or hate their chocolate popcorn.
Boy, oh boy, don't they.
My wife, who is a popcorn lover, can't stand it. She doesn't like chocolate to begin with so much,
so, like,
but the whole smell of it and everything, I don't mind it. I think it's just kind of a little, I don't mind the chocolate popcorn.
You know,
but
it reminds,
I prefer a caramel corn.
Yes, I would prefer caramel corn too. It reminds me a little bit of Cocoa Puffs, that old school cereal that they probably still make, but there's something about it, the corn, the chocolate, that really takes me back to those old school chocolate cereals.
Yeah. Never had it, and doesn't sound that great. So I'm going to stick with my regular popcorn.
All right. So then, Chef, when you go out for you end up getting surprised. Let's say you're going to one that came to my mind when we were talking about this was Swanson's Nursery, right? You don't expect to get into a little cafe at Swanson's Nursery, mm-hmm. but they have a delicious little deli/cafe there,
yeah.
and I quite enjoy the food there. It's unexpected, right? It's unexpected surprise.
You know where I was. I only discovered it a couple of years ago, was Nordstrom.
Oh, I love the Nordstrom Basement Grill.
You do? I like how you just...
Katie just felt like she had to come clean, just like that.
You can find me there before I go and spend too much money at Nordstrom.
Well, you know what? I mean, I've been there without, you know, meeting people for a meeting or whatever at the bar, mm-hmm. and then eat a little bite, and I was surprised. Then the food was decent and was actually really good, and,
uh-huh.
and I was like, wow. This is kind of a... It would never in a million years come to my mind to think, I'm going to go eat at Nordstrom. Obviously, it's the wrong place to go.
Well, Nordstrom owns like 250 restaurants.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, I was very shocked the first time I discovered that, and been back a few times, mm-hmm. and mostly for cocktail, but you know, I think it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A place that I've been wanting to try is the new Nordic Museum in Ballard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have not been there either.
When they were building that, they had an RFP, a request for a proposal out for the food service, because you know all those museums now have a little snack bar.
Right.
They have there's a big one, Taste, down at the Seattle
the
Art
same,
Museum,
yeah.
right? So I've been curious about getting some traditional Norwegian food at the Nordic Museum, because there's very little out there. Ballard used to be full of it. I used to go to Scandi's Cafe for brunch, and used to go to Johansson's Deli there on Market Avenue, but there's just
gone.
Are
those places gone?
Well, there's one deli called Scandia on 15th, past 65th. I'm not sure, it's like 68th or something like that, right by the Midas.
Get your muffler fixed and have a bite.
Exactly.
I've always wanted to go to, and clearly I've not done a very good job of it, because I've known these places have existed for a long time and that actually have a lot of events centered around food, but the Swedish Cultural Center would also be a place.
Mm-hmm.
And the Polish...
Instead of IKEA for Swedish meatballs.
That's right. Yeah. And the Polish Cultural Center, I hear, has a really fun little Friday night of eating, like, sausages and kraut and
pierogies.
Pierogies. I'm assuming
they're
there.
Right on 23rd and Madison there.
Yep. Maybe you and I should go. That's in our neighborhood.
We should. I've been wanting to go there. It's every Friday night. You can go to the hall and they have food. And I'm like, I've been wanting to try this for years, and I keep forgetting. The problem is you keep forgetting about these places.
And it's hard to give. I mean, for me, it's difficult to give up a Friday night. You have to go on for, you know, that's the busiest night in our restaurants, and it's difficult for me to get out on a Friday night.
Right.
But I would like to plan some of these little forays. Sarah, have you found any other place?
For me, one that was really unexpected was the Clipper to Victoria. Had pretty good food on it. Yeah, it was. It's a nice little ride over to Victoria. Takes a couple of hours, and it's a great place. You have to go pretty early if you want to spend a full day there. It's a great little place to grab breakfast. Is just at the.
Do they have crumpets and tea?
They most certainly do, along with all the other like little packaged breakfast foods you can think of, and they're all pretty good. And that always surprises me whenever I'm on my way over.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought about it, but of course the Washington State ferry system is somewhat the same way, right? You get on there.
Glass of wine.
Same with the train, Tom. You do food for the train.
I used to do food for the train.
On track. I mean, it's the same thing. They have food on those trains, and sometimes it's surprisingly delicious. You never expect to think about that way.
Right.
One thing that I think that America could take a cue from Tokyo, from my quick little trip over there, is the convenience stores.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen a better convenience store. And I think actually quite a few people in that city live out of those convenience stores. They live in very small spaces, and kitchens are, you know, not very big at a premium. And you can go there and get a really delicious, healthful meal front to back from one of those little convenience stores.
And throughout the UK, you can also find that like at the Marks and Spencers at the gas stations, right?
Mm-hmm.
You walk in there and it's a buffet of freshly packed daily food, kind of like a prêt-manger. Have you seen those sandwich shops?
So
fresh and fascinating in London. And now they're in New York, and I think Chicago, too.
There is some in New York.
Yeah. So it's interesting, all the different places. You know, even now you go into a CVS pharmacy or a Walgreens and they have a whole wall of fast packaged food. Now, I'm not saying that's delicious, but it's changing.
They're
quickly
catering to that market.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, much like the movie theater, which has always to some degree had some food, I mean, the options are just so much different now at a place like the Cinerama. I would also say Safeco Field and CenturyLink, you know, places that have traditionally always had food have really stepped up their game. I mean, it's almost a little odd to be in Safeco and have Din Tai Fung as an option these days.
Or Fossiclo Pho, right?
Yeah.
So I would always encourage people to write us on our Facebook page and tell us where they found the most delicious little unexpected items.
We're always looking.
We'll have a post about it you can respond to.
All right. We're hosting a dinner party, or at least Katie is, at her house. I'm just the cook. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen in Cairo Radio at the Hot Stove Society. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in the hat.
And I am Katie O. And it is time for you guys to finally get some work done. Come over to my place because we're having a dinner party.
And for, you know, to make matters worse, she didn't even have to buy the meal, main course.
It's my favorite. Absolute favorite thing. Free food, free help. It's the best. Today, we are going to do a dinner party based on the beautiful king crab that Captain Sean Dwyer from The Deadliest Catch brought to us. We were so inspired tasting that luscious, luscious crab that we had to do a dinner party. And you know what? Since he was kind enough to bring the product, he's going to be our guest.
Oh, that's very nice.
It doesn't have anything to do that he was a husky, handsome, 26-year-old.
Nope.
Stud.
Nope, I'm
no,
a married woman.
No,
it had
nothing
woman.
To do with that.
I'm a married, monogamous, committed woman, Tom.
Okay.
How dare you?
Just checking.
But I do love crab.
You do have eyes.
I do love crab.
Yeah.
I do love crab. All right, so let's kick off this party right. What are we starting with? What are we going to have?
I think we should start with champagne and nice little crustini of... I went to Tom's freezer and that tomato paste... jam that he has in his freezer.
Mm-hmm.
Sounded really delicious. So I'm like, took some of that, mixed them with a little bit of crushed olives, put that on the base of the crustini, and then put some wonderful crab legs right on top of that, and a little bit of salted olive oil right on top, and then used that with a glass of champagne, and I thought that was a very nice little start.
Mm-hmm.
That does sound like a nice little start.
Okay, fine.
Okay, fine.
I'm doing a crab, avocado, and grapefruit salad. I just love that.
I was going to say, that's a kind of a classic little combo.
It is. I don't know if it's classic in my world or if that's classic out there somewhere.
I think it's classic in my world for sure.
I was going to say, maybe I'm just so familiar with your worlds, the two of you, that it feels classic to me at this point.
I think we've been serving that for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I'm going to take I'm going to section the both of them, right? I'm actually going to pick the crab on this one. I'm going to section it, and we're going to section the grapefruit at the same time, and then nice little chunks of avocado, make a little lime vinaigrette. But I like this with bib lettuce. For some reason, bib lettuce, that soft quality of bib lettuce, and the velvety nature of crab and avocado, to me, is a nice combination.
Yeah.
But we have to have a little crunch, so we're going to make a little sesame crisp, a sesame tweel, kind of maybe out of black sesame.
Yeah.
To go make a little crunchies to go on top of our crab, grapefruit, and avocado salad.
What is it about the combination of avocado and grapefruit and crab that is so tasty? Mm. It's just kind of, it brings out the creaminess and the brininess.
Salty crab,
yeah.
Sour grapefruit, creamy
delicious.
Avocado.
I think for entree, I'm going to do there's beautiful celery root that are coming in season right now. I'm going to do almost like a risotto idea of celery root and use crab legs, those crab legs, lightly steamed.
Wait. Roll it back. What do you mean a risotto of celery root?
So you take the celery root, you julienne it, and then you cook it very slowly in cream and seafood stock, very gently until everything is cooked down, tender. Finish with some fresh herb, probably tarragon, a little bit of tarragon because it's in the end of the season again, and using that flavor to perk up the whole dish, and then steam some Alaskan king crab very gently, not too much, just to get them hot, and then finish with a drizzle of truffle oil right on top of that, truffle and the maid. Truffle blended with some nice olive oil, the two together, and then drizzle that right on top. And I think that'd be quite a lovely dish.
That'd be a lovely entree.
Lovely.
Do you think Sean would like that entree?
I don't think so. So I'm going to make it a little different.
Whoa, rough time.
Well, Sean's a rugged dude. He doesn't eat little cream.
Yeah, but he looked like
he has
eat
little
taste.
Cream-soaked celery root.
He looks like he's got taste, and he's capable of judging.
I know. I'm going to make something for him that actually has taste.
Okay, go
ahead. Wow, them's fighting words at the dinner party.
Truffle and crab doesn't have any taste.
It's only because I can't figure out what to do for dessert.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, what are you going to do for a crab dessert?
We're going to have a second entree.
No dessert?
And no dessert.
Okay.
And I'm going to take a walk and get it burning hot on the stove, right? And we're going to, the crab has been slacked properly. We talked about that. You have to let the crab thaw naturally right in the refrigerator. Pull it the day before, right? And then we're going to take it and we're going to cut it down into about 2-inch chunks. so that there's access points for my sauce to get in.
Is it in the shell?
It's in the shell, but in 2-inch chunks. So, because I want sauce to get inside the shell. So that's now ready to go, sitting right there by my stove. On my hottest, best burner on the stove, I've got my wok getting burning hot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put a bunch of peanut oil in there. I'm going to start to saute. We're going to work a black bean sauce, a Chinese black bean sauce, right? So that's fermented mung beans. That is red peppers, both hot and sweet. That is a sliced onion. And then it's going to, we're going to saute that in my burning hot wok. And then we're going to add a little bit of Chinese rice wine, a little bit of vinegar, and a little bit of chicken stock. And we're going to have some cornstarch and thicken that up into, and our mung beans, our fermented mung beans.
Right?
Now I've got my black bean sauce. And you notice what's happened so far. My dish is cooked, but my crab is still off the fire, right?
Because
with king crab, you cannot heat it up past, say, 105 degrees, or else all the moisture bleeds out of it.
This is not a time to, like, stew anything.
Correct. So now I'm going to take my 2-inch chunks, and I'm going to toss them into my hot sauce, stir it around just to take chill off the crab, but it's already kind of warmed up by the side of the stove. But so it's just going to be a minute. And now I'm going to serve that with luscious jasmine steamed rice.
Mm.
And we're going to have...
This sounds so good.
That sounds so good right now.
Sauce.
This is making me miss like the old sea garden.
I know.
Things of that nature where that you could get like really delicious seafood prepared just like that. Well,
so that's my idea. And then you do have to put a little bit of spice in there. So use some, I like to use that sambal oleg, which is kind of a chili paste.
Right.
Or you could, everyone has sriracha now, you can just pour a little sriracha in there. Be good.
I'm really glad that we skipped dessert.
Me too. And do you think Sean's glad too? He's a big dude.
I think he'll be okay for one meal without dessert.
Yeah.
I think you've put in the hard work here. You've brought a lot of flavor to the table.
We could give him an apple to go.
Yeah, we'll have a little tea or we'll have a little whiskey to finish. A
little whiskey. There you go.
Don't you think of those guys on The Deadliest Catch being kind of whiskey guys?
I do, but then I think about how dangerous it is and how they should probably stay like super sober on those boats. You could just fall right off.
There's no more reason to get drunk than being on one of those boats.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Yeah. I just see one of those shows and I get real scared, scared for them.
I get seasick just watching them.
Yeah.
So have you seen the show on TV?
Yes, I've seen this show. Have you seen the show on
Who's
TV?
Who's your favorite captain? I have not seen it since Sean's been on. He's only been on a couple years.
Sean's my favorite captain.
Well, come on.
Duh. What else was I going to say?
Yeah.
She's
no
got him
answer.
Here. She's got him at his, I don't know, house.
Yeah, exactly. You can't insult the guest.
What kind of music are we going to play for Sean? Do you know that much about him? You seem
no,
to know
I don't.
A lot about Sean.
No, I really don't know.
I'm a little worried right now for Elijah.
I think we'll play your playlist. What would that be, Tom?
My playlist? I was just in Alaska with Brandi Carlile.
Okay. Well, so that feels like a natural for you.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like a natural for Sean, though. He probably likes REO Speedwagon or something
REO
like that.
Speedwagon. I wonder if he would be offended
are they
by
a band?
That.
Yeah, I think I'm probably.
He's
with
also
you, Tom.
Like 26.
Like Pearl Jam.
Like he's
oh, he's
young,
26. Yeah, so he probably likes Drake.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe 0 to 100.
You didn't think I knew it.
Yeah.
You didn't think I knew, did you?
I didn't actually.
Up next, we have the Baker's Corner with Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dolly Bakery on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And Katie O.
Time for the Baker's Corner. Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery has joined us. And, you know, let's talk upside down cake.
Yes. Let's.
Let's.
It's delicious cake.
And, you know, I want to say last week we talked that we're going to talk apples this week. So let's start. My favorite upside down cake is tart tatin.
That was good.
Yeah. I love a perfect tart tatin.
Yes, such a simple, elegant, delicious
last week
dessert.
On the show, I made a quince tatin.
Really?
Yeah.
Where'd you get your quinces?
From my backyard.
Really?
They're not ready yet.
Oh,
but
I was gonna say.
On the show.
On the show.
Okay. Virtual.
Gotcha. Virtual quince tart tatin.
In 3 weeks from now, you get plenty of time to train.
Yeah.
So let's start with, if you don't mind. Can
no,
we start
I do
with
not
a
mind. With an apple tart tatin. Well, or a... I love to make tart tatin. I like to make them individual in ramekins, which might be cheating. I don't know. I know.
Wow.
Why is that cheating?
Because I feel like with tartatans or upside down cakes, the idea is you get a big iron skillet out and it's rustic and homey and fun. But we're a little more refined at the Dahlia Bakery and at the Dahlia Lounge, and we want each guest to have their very own
personal
cake with all the caramelized gooey fruit they could possibly
want. You
want
to make sure you have the best bite, and when it's all yours, you can make sure you have the best bite in
there. Exactly. I like tartatan with puff dough. Some people use pie dough, but I think it's just more, I don't know, it's just more of a showstopper when you've got those layers that you can look at. But
I'm definitely pie dough.
Pie dough.
I think puff dough tends to steam up a little bit.
I mean, you have to cook it for a long time.
I'll take my tartatin, however, you want to make it for me.
So now you've got peeled, let's say, Granny Smith apples?
Or a nice tart, firm apple of any kind. Just make a caramel sauce. Burn some caramel or burn some fruit, sugar. And I add a little butter to mine, and that's it.
You should always put butter in.
Cook it until it's a nice amber, until it's the color you want it to be. Add a few tablespoons of butter, and that softens it a little bit and stops the cooking. And then I ladle it into ramekins that I've buttered up really well.
All the butter.
And let that sit and set that aside while you're preparing your peeled apples. And I just, you know, slice them. And you can do sort of a concentric pattern. And so when you flip it out, it looks really pretty. And then you just top it with your raw dough. Pop it in the oven and let it hang out.
I like to macerate my apple quarters into a little bit of vanilla sugar and calvados. So it gives extra apple flavor. And then you put that in your caramel.
And do you do a whole one, a big whole tartatin?
You can't make a small tartatin.
I don't know. She just kind of said she did.
No, you can for the rest of them, but I mean, for me, I'm making a whole one. There's no way I'm going to make a small one for me.
I love it when those apples are just all tucked in right around in a concentric circle. When they come out, they're all lined up and luscious.
And then you take a spatula and you push gently on them, and then you take all that syrup, all the caramel that's on the bottom of the pan, and then put a little bit more extra calvados and not get the butter. And then you put that right over your apples, and it forms that gorgeous...
Chef, are you going to be okay right now?
I was going to say, this is incredible.
Do we need to leave you alone?
I feel like you all
I'll be right back.
Oh, my God.
Tartatin way more than I am, and I'm having a little, like, FOMO. I'm having a little bit of jealousy. And
you turn it out onto a platter.
You take it, the crust is up. You have a little hole in your crust, so the crust doesn't steam, but release the steam. Then you flip it back on this on the crust side. And then you take all that sauce, and then you just take a spatula and gently move all your apple until they're totally tight together and form one little... And then some vanilla ice cream on top of that.
Just have to take a moment for Terry right now.
I love how he's rubbing his tummy while he does it.
Okay, what other upside down upside down things can we do?
I'm just a classic upside down cake girl. That's going to be my preferred dessert.
You mean pineapple upside down?
I do not mean
pineapple. Or just the cake.
The upside down cake, but everybody wants pineapple upside down cake. I disagree. I think pineapples are too sweet for upside down cake.
Interesting.
And this is my favorite time of year to make upside down cake, because you've got the plums, which is my hands down favorite. Upside down cake. They've got, when they bake, they become tart. And that with the caramel sauce.
So do the apricots when they were in season. They were the same thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But you can also do apples and pears, which are coming into season. There's all kinds of things. Figs, as we were talking about earlier. And I, again, like to do mine as an individual cake. You can do a whole one, of course. There's a couple of little steps. You make a sort of a soft caramel sauce, and it's not even really a caramel sauce. It's just butter and brown sugar that you're going to cook on the stove till it bubbles up and the sugar dissolves. And then I always add a couple of tablespoons of booze.
I'm with you, girl.
What's that?
I'm with you.
Oh, yeah.
What's your booze of choice?
So if I'm doing plums, I like to use Armagnac or brandy. If I'm doing apples, I love Applejack, which is the more affordable version of Calvados. If I'm doing pineapple, I would do rum.
Malibu rum.
It's a nice Malibu rum.
No.
A lovely dark rum for a pineapple upside down cake.
Then that wouldn't be Malibu. Yeah. That would be something else.
So then first of all, you're going to prep your pan. I use a pan spray, Pam, whatever. And then line So spray your pan and then line the inside of your pan with a circle of parchment paper and then spray it again.
Oh,
this is a critical step. Yep. If you don't spray that parchment paper again, it will stick to the caramelized fruit.
Yet again.
Because that sugar will stick to the pan.
Absolutely. I say give yourself all the insurance you could possibly use to make sure this comes out cleanly.
Again, you're going through all the trouble of doing this.
Exactly. Let's make it beautiful.
Yeah, let's just do this one little simple step.
So once I've added my caramel to the bottom of the pan, I put it in the fridge and let it get tacky. So it's when you go to put your fruit on there, it doesn't scooch around from that soft caramel.
Oh, interesting. Caramel. It has something to kind of hold on to.
Exactly. You want it to be just sort of have a little give to it, but it's going to that fruit will stick.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also another critical step. So get it in the fridge, prep your fruit, and then you can, you know, make whatever pattern you want. If you're doing them individual, you could just sort of line them up, fan your fruit, then pop it in the freezer so that everything gets completely solid, and then you make your cake batter. The reason you freeze it is when you put your cake batter on there and you're smearing it around, it's
nothing
yet another
gooey
chance to scooch your fruit. You want it to stay in place.
No scooching
no
your fruit.
No scooching of the fruit.
No fruit scooch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If your fruit does scooch, I will say once you flip it out, you can do a little surgery. Like you were talking about earlier with your
tarts
of tan. It's the same idea. Yeah, yeah. But I use a
or
sort of
say, they call me the doctor because I know right where to put the whipped cream on top.
Yeah, that is
always covers up the scooch.
That is another reason you make whipped cream for anything. It's nice covering.
Yeah.
Oops, boo-boo. Whipped cream.
We should talk about the cake that I personally prefer for upside-down cake. Mm-hmm. I like a fluffy sour cream cake.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost got the consistency of a coffee cake.
Right.
It's a thicker batter. I like it that way because it sort of holds up. It's sturdy under that fruit. Yet when you cut into it, it's tender. You get that tang from the sour cream to sort of counteract with the really rich brown sugar.
Delicious.
It's just
what about that lovely cake for the peach upside down cake in the book called Tom's Big Dinners?
What about
do you think of that cake?
What about that one?
It's the best.
Tom, that cake's been reinvented now.
We are serving a plum upside down cake at the Dahlia Lounge right now with a little cinnamon brandy ice cream.
Yeah.
I highly encourage if you're in the neighborhood stopping in to
And we talk about this this upside down cake. I think we can classify it as a cake, but it, it's from Jackie, right? And has butternut squash.
That's a gingerbread.
Yes. Oh, Lord.
I think about that as an upside down cake, but you're right.
It is an upside down cake technically, but that's probably better than my upside down cake now that we talk about
it. Oh, I don't think it is. It's just different.
It's different. It's that gingerbread, the recipe for that gingerbread itself is the best gingerbread I've ever had. It's spicy and dark and rich. Almost has a little chew to it.
But let's talk about the topping for that. So it's an upside down cake. You're right. Uh-huh. And this one, that's actually my recipe.
Oh, I'm sorry. I attributed it to your beautiful wife.
I just took a butternut squash. Mm-hmm. I peeled it. And then I put, I lined it around like you would a plum or an apple or anything. I lined it around the bottom of the pan.
Mm-hmm.
Did the same caramel setup. But it's... It isn't more savory because butternut squash is sweet.
They're very
sweet. But it seems more savory.
Oh, and it's just an interesting way to
see it very often.
That particular vegetable, which is everywhere at a certain point of the year, in a different way that I think is kind of fun and unexpected.
Yeah. That's also a great place for Anjou pears on top of a gingerbread.
Yeah.
Love those pears.
Yeah.
So, since you hate pineapple upside down,
I don't hate it.
How do you get your game on when you're trying to figure out where to put the cherry? You know, because that really, the center of that ring and that cherry in the center of that ring is very beautiful.
When you're making also baked ham with the same...
Tom, if you core an apple, you cut it in half, and you put the two halves together, the cherry goes straight in the middle.
There you go.
I am anti-cherry in my upside-down
cherry.
Yeah.
I use carrot slices myself.
Yeah. Unless it's a pineapple upside-down cake.
You had the nerve bust me on a banana split, and you don't like pineapple upside-down cake.
I know.
Here we go. It's just my least favorite upside-down cake.
Okay. Another Facebook war.
It, but,
you could also,
eat it.
In that scenario, use a good carrot cake for your cake batter, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah.
Carrot and pineapple, for some reason.
Yes.
Classic combination.
No.
Available year-round.
No, you don't get away with that. No way.
Oh, yeah. Oftentimes, carrot cake has pineapple chunks
in it. Oh, yeah. My recipe for carrot cake, this is a big controversy over at the Dahlia Bakery, but yes, I like pineapple in my carrot cake.
All right, we're going to cut you off there.
Yeah,
it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia right here on Kiowa Radio, coming up next. You're back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio. Thank you all for hanging with us. I know it's been a long couple hours.
But hopefully it flew by.
It flew by, I'm sure. And remember, you can always download us. If you can't get us all straight away on the radio, you can always download us as a podcast.
That's right. On iTunes or Stitcher, or you can download the Cairo Radio app.
We've invited Chef Lexi Ochoa here from the Hot Stove Society to be our fresh catch in the, in the Tasty Trivia Challenge.
Uh-huh.
Because we're always looking for a loser.
Oh, just all that smack talk.
All that she smack talk.
Yeah, really exactly. Amps her up for a good game.
She's very competitive, so.
She's
luckily,
very competitive.
And luckily, very smart.
Lexi, is your mom still in the audience?
She is.
Oh, perfect. Yay. You can show her how clever you are compared to these two
I think she pretty
chefs.
Much, she pretty much knows that.
Yeah, I think she knows that. I think her mom knows that. Okay. All right, so this is our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. You're each going to receive five questions. Whoever gets the most correct wins, and whoever gets the least amount correct is the loser and has to give something to one of our listeners. Today, it's someone in our audience. It's Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
He's been taking a lot of photos and I think got a few selfies in, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, man, he was doing some close-ups on himself.
And he, broke sure it. And he brought his own tea.
Sure was. Tom, should you lose today, what will you give away to Paul?
To Paul, who seems to like tea, we're going to give lunch at the Dahlia Lounge for him and three of his closest friends.
Wow.
I think lunch for four. Do you live in the neighborhood, Paul?
Nearby.
Nearby. So he can make it to lunch at the Dahlia.
Perfect.
There you go. You leave it's a $100 value, Paul.
Thierry Rotaro.
Brunch for two on Saturday or Sunday at Luke.
All right, Lexi.
And Lexi, what are you going to give away?
We have a cookbook author coming in on Thursday, October 4th. Rose Levi Barenbaum.
Levy. Rose Levy Barenbaum.
Cake Bible?
The queen of
the cake.
The
cake Bible.
Yeah, cake Bible.
She's releasing her book, Rose's Baking Basics, and is doing a wonderful class with us.
Great.
Awesome.
So, two tickets to that.
Cool.
I got to make sure that gets on my calendar. She's a pal of mine. So.
Awesome. Is she a pal of yours? Yeah. We've done some things with her in the past, back when we used to work together.
Yep.
Thierry, you love to go first and kick it off. So, are you ready?
Let's do it.
All right. Which kind of beef is more nutritious? Is it grain-fed beef or grass-fed beef?
That's a trick question. Nutritious.
Yeah. If you went by this survey of the audience says... Grass!
I'm going to go with the healthiest is grass.
That is correct. The audience is right. You are right. Your second question. What is Chev?
Chev is a cheese is made.
There we go.
The translation in English is, we call it Chev, but it should be fromage de Chev. That's the entire term. For all of you who try to speak French correctly, Chev means goat.
Fromage de chèvre
is goat cheese.
What herb with silvery green, needle-shaped leaves is an age-old symbol of remembrance?
I'm going to go with rosemary.
You are correct. Very nice. 3 out of 3. Your fourth question. What Scottish dish is made by stuffing a sheep's stomach lining with its organs and other ingredients?
Oatmeal, to be exact.
Oatmeal. Lots of oats.
Lots of oats.
Very oaty. What do you call that silly dish that everybody talks
about?
Oh,
it's not silly.
Yes, it's Scottish.
It's quite classic.
Let me see.
Or classique.
Haggis?
Haggis is correct. Very nice.
Boy, the audience is very friendly today.
Yeah.
Your
final question for a potentially perfect score here. Which squash is oval-shaped with dark green skin and orange flesh? Is it a spaghetti squash, an acorn squash, or a butternut squash?
I'm going to go with the acorn.
That's the shape of an acorn. That is correct. Wow, Jerry Rotaro.
Wow. They need to get their eyes
checked. Rocked that one.
Yeah. Acorn, oval, ovular-esque, I suppose.
My guess is it's acorn-shaped.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's why they called it that.
Acorn?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Thierry, either way, you get 5 out of 5. Nice work today. Lexi, are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead. You can applaud. It's okay.
You can Lexi, you're a smart cookie. What is albumin commonly known as?
Egg white.
That is correct. Very nice.
Be more.
Egg white.
Be more.
Yes.
Yeah.
You got it. What starchy substance comes from the root of the cassava plant?
Tapioca.
Very nice. Correct. Lexi, what
this
official...
This is not going to be fun for me today.
Yeah, I know. She's not even hesitating.
Tom, can you just like pretend you don't know for a second?
Just make an noise for Tom's, you
there
know,
was
ego.
One, there were like four questions about like very rare English dishes, like countryside dishes. Mm-hmm. I didn't get any of those, Craig. Okay. So
all right,
maybe you'll have your wish, Tom.
Yeah. What? Okay, here's your next one. Let's see. Uh-huh. What official state drink of Rhode Island is made by mixing milk and coffee syrup? There are multiple choices.
Finally, we have an
I could make something up.
Okay.
Café au lait.
Café au lait. That's a great made-up one.
I don't know. Coffee. Wait, it's not coffee syrup.
Coffee milk. Coffee soda with cream.
Oh.
Coffee soda with cream?
No, it's actually coffee milk. I thought my hesitation in adding there might have helped you out a little bit. That was a tough one, Lexi. All right,
it doesn't even have an actual name. You're just putting those words together.
That's right.
Okay.
That's the name. I'm just putting words together. Lexi, is a sea bean an animal, a vegetable, or a legume?
A vegetable.
That is correct. And your final question, true or false? Gelatin, when ingested, has been shown to strengthen hair and nails. Is that true or false?
I feel like that sounds like that could be reasonable. We'll say true.
It's actually false. It's one of those old wives' tales. Still, a respectable score of 3 out of 5.
Way to go, Lex.
Okay, Tom.
Gave me a window.
Bring it in.
Gave me a window.
Tom, true or false? Chinese 1,000-year-old eggs are actually only preserved for 1 to 6 weeks before being ready to eat. Is that true or false?
That is true.
That is false.
No hesitation.
They're actually preserved for 1 to 6 months, so a little bit longer. Not.
Oh, so it's a trick question.
It is a little tricky. We kind of tricked you there. Your next question, Tom. What is yuzu?
It's a type of motorcycle.
That's when you walk into a cage and then you is a zoo.
Use a zoo. Use a mess.
You go sleep in a cage.
You're the man.
Like that's when you're looking a little bedraggled.
Yeah.
Use a zoo.
Yeah, you didn't
no,
get your shower this
you
morning.
You know what this is. Come
it's
on.
It's a fruit. It's a citrus fruit.
That's correct. It is a citrus fruit. Tom, approximately how many distinct varieties of rice are found worldwide? I'll give you some options. 100,000, 10,000, or 1,000?
I'm going to go with 100,000.
You are correct. There's a lot of rice out there.
What?
Holy moly.
Your fourth question, which Japanese noodle is made from buckwheat?
Ooh. Okay, let's talk about this earlier.
I don't know.
Oh, sure did.
Let me think. Soba?
Yes.
Yes, very nice. Your last question, Tom. What spicy staple of Mexican cooking is named after the city of Jalapa?
Oh... That's easy.
Come on, Tom.
I got this. I'm just looking at Lexi because she's crying right now. I will say the jalapeno.
That is correct. Si, senor. You got 4 out of 5. Very nice. That means, Lexi, you are the loser this week. But you did a really great job, and you had some hard questions.
Okay, and thank you very much, Katie, for coming on.
That's right. So Paul gets 2 tickets to the Rose Levy Barenboim cake cooking class coming up on October, right? October
something.
4th.
Yes. If you want to be part of our show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter. And by the way, Rose Levy is the queen of baking. You are listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Tina Noah at Large Media. Our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz. Very lovely. And our sound engineer is Sean, don't call me Del Torre, please. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. It includes breakfast. And remember, if you missed any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.